Please be advised that the views and opinions expressed by Richard Martin of LATAM Investments, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent those of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments made on the basis of Mr. Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener or investor.
Again, ladies and gentlemen, the end of what I hope was a very nice weekend for you all, and the beginning of another trying week in the markets, in the economy, and probably in the lives of most of you. First of all, I just want to remind you that at the end of this month, I will be taking a leave of absence in order to transport my body and my worldly possessions to the great and wonderful city-state of Singapore, and in so doing, I shall be out of touch with the ability to speak to you, although I will be consulting my computer regularly for email updates. But please, when you get to listen to my talks during that period, the period of July and about half of August, please be aware that I am not able to take your calls, and therefore do not call me, but do email me by all means at rmartin@lataminv.com, LATAMINV, rmartin@lataminv.com. That's for your questions and your comments, both private and for public consumption. Although I don't suppose I'll be able to read many of your emails on the air, I will take them and answer them and make sure that you get satisfaction one way or another. In the meantime, if you think the housing slump can't get much worse, Martin Feldstein thinks that both home prices and the broader economy can and very likely will get a whole lot worse. Martin Feldstein is a Harvard University professor and former chief economic advisor to Ronald Reagan, and you really cannot consider him as part of the crowd that usually forecasts doom. So when he spoke this past week, his grim calculations were noteworthy. There are now 12 million homes in the United States with a loan-to-value ratio greater than 100%. That's one mortgage in four. The aggregate amount of that is some $2 trillion, according to Feldstein. If you look at the median, the midpoint loan-to-value in that 12 million group of underwater mortgages, which is, of course, mortgages with negative equity, the median loan-to-value ratio is 120%, a very dismal development. That means about 25% of all U.S. mortgages exceed the value of the homes those mortgages are financing. In the case of half the homes that are underwater, homeowners are paying a mortgage that's now 20% higher than the value of the home. Now, this is quite bad, but it's likely to get a lot worse. A recent report by First American Core Logic estimated that as of the 30th of September 2008, 7.5 million mortgages, or 18% of all properties with a mortgage, had negative equity. The group thinks there are another 2.1 million mortgages that are within 5% of going under. Together, these two categories account for 23% of all properties with a mortgage. If home prices fall another 10 to 15%, as measured by the Case-Shiller Home Price Index, then 4 out of every 10 mortgages in the United States could be underwater, Feldstein stated. At those levels, it's hard to see how many people are going to be willing to keep up with their mortgages. The implications for many homeowners are staggering. Before the recent housing boom of 2000 to 2005 or 2006, homes increased in value at a historical annual rate of about 2.3% when adjusted for inflation. That means that for homeowners who owe 35% more than their home's value, it would take, at historical averages, about 15 years just to break even on their home investment. So in essence, they won't be building equity for quite a long time. As such, it would be a huge incentive for millions to just hand their keys back to the lenders and seek cheaper housing elsewhere. The next problem is the $60 to $75 billion of adjustable rate Alt-A mortgages, which fall between subprime and prime loans. Millions of these loans are scheduled to reset next year to higher interest rates. That could bring monthly mortgage payment increases of $1,000 or more if the loans aren't modified or refinanced. All this is happening amid what is now clearly a deepening recession, with the highest job losses and deepest drops in consumer spending in decades. As jobs continue to be slashed and outsourced in growing numbers, a growing number of American homeowners with once solid credit are falling way behind on their mortgages, implying the current tsunami wave of mega foreclosures. In the latest phase, and there will be two more, in the latest phase of America's real estate crisis, the host of contagions has shifted from subprime loans, those extended to home buyers with troubled credit, to the far more numerous prime types of loans issued to those with decent financial histories. Many economists, most of whom always underestimate the contagion, are anticipating that the unemployment rate will rise into the double digits. Foreclosures are expected to continue to accelerate, which will likely exacerbate more bank losses and will add more negative pressure to the financial system and the broader economy. Foreclosures were bad last year, and it's going to get worse for the next several years. Economists refer to the current surge of foreclosures as the third wave. First it was the flippers, then it was the subprime borrowers. And now it's the prime borrowers, those who have lost their jobs or some portion of their income, or who, for whatever other reason in a souring economy, can no longer afford to make their mortgage payments. And these are distinct from the initial spike when speculators gave up property because of plunging real estate prices, and the secondary shock when borrowers' introductory interest rates expired and were reset higher. We're right in the middle of this wave, and it's intensifying. The loss of jobs and loss of overtime hours and being forced from a full-time to part-time job is resulting in more and more defaults from coast to coast. Those sliding into foreclosure today are more likely to be modest borrowers whose loans fit their income than the consumers of exotically easygoing mortgages that formerly typified the subprime slime slide. I read that we can expect that 60% of the mortgage defaults this year and next will be set off primarily by unemployment, up from 29% last year. From November to February, the number of prime mortgages that were delinquent at least 90 days were in foreclosure or had deteriorated to the point that the lender took possession of the home, increased more than 473,000, exceeding 1.5 million, according to a New York Times analysis of data provided by First American CoreLogic, while those loans totaled more than $225 billion. During the same period, subprime mortgages in those three categories increased by fewer than 14,000, reaching 1.65 million. The number of similarly troubled Alt-A loans, those given to people with slightly tainted credit, rose 159,000 to 836,000. Overall, more than 4 million loans worth $720 billion were in the three distressed categories in February, a jump of more than 60% in dollar terms compared with a year earlier. And these are green shoots, not. Under a program announced in February by the Obama administration, the government is able to spend $75 billion on incentives for mortgage servicing companies that reduce payments for troubled homeowners. The Treasury Department says the program will spare as many as 4 million homeowners from foreclosure. But 3 months after the program was announced, a Treasury spokeswoman estimated the number of loans that had been modified were in the range of 10,000 to 55,000, a huge spread in a very mediocre total at best. In the first 2 months of this year alone, another 315,000 mortgages landed in foreclosure or became delinquent at least 90 days, according to First American CoreLogic. And this, of course, is a very dismal trend. I don't think there's any chance of this bailout program making more than a smidgen of a dent in this growing contagion. The green shoots are going to turn into tumbleweeds quickly in this scenario. Last year, foreclosures expanded sharply as the economy shed an average of 256,000 jobs each month. Now we are hemorrhaging more than twice that a month. Since then, the job market has deteriorated further, with an average of 665,000 jobs vanishing each month. Oh, I forgot, in the first 100 days, Obama added 110,000 jobs, or so he says. Worse yet, each foreclosure costs lenders $55,000, according to data cited in a 2006 study by the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago. So an additional 2 million foreclosures could mean $100 billion in lender losses. But they will surely find some exotic accounting maneuver to hide those losses. There you are, ladies and gentlemen. Quite a few statistics there, but you've got to do them from time to time. You need to know. All right, this is Richard Martin. This is Richard Martin's wake-up call coming to you from Miami in Florida. After a few days of devastating drenchings and floods and thunderstorms, which I haven't seen since I first arrived here 9 years ago, but they're back. So anyway, actually, we need the rain. The drought situation is becoming critical here. But anyway, so my call-in line, if you'd like to call in and ask a question, is 888-873-4643. Let me give you that number once again. It is 888-873-4643. And I do encourage you to call, ladies and gentlemen, and it's your line and it's your program, and what I want to do more than anything else is to satisfy your needs. So I can only know what they are if you call in and let me know them. Always happy to advise if you want to send in your questions by email. That is perfectly okay, too. And the email address is rmartin@latamenv.com. Once again, and Lataminv is L-A-T-A-M-I-N-V, which is not actually short for Latin American Investments, but it could be. So once again, the email address is rmartin@latamenv.com. And finally, if you would like to call me personally to discuss your own issues and concerns, you may do so. And the number to call is 305-579-2012. That's my personal number, my direct line. And if you call that number and I'm not in the office, it will be call forwarded to my cell phone. So one way or another, you shouldn't have a problem getting hold of me. Once again, the number is 305-579-2012. All right. Well, just a few more statistics, not overwhelming, but nevertheless impressive. As economic conditions deteriorate and unemployment continues to soar, 1 in 9 Americans are now on food stamps. Moreover, a staggering $1 of every $6 of Americans' income is now coming in the form of a federal or state check or voucher. And this is from the USDA, by the way, who states that 1 in 9 Americans are using federal food stamps to help buy groceries as the country's deep recession forced another 591,000 people onto the federal anti-hunger program at latest count. Enrollment jumped 2% to 33.2 million people in March, the fourth consecutive month that rolls hit a record, according to the Agricultural Department. The average monthly benefit was $113.87 per person. And Jim Weil, president of the Food Research and Action Center, said, and I quote, "It's tough out there for struggling families and will be for many months to come." In 20 states, as many as 1 in 8 are on the food stamp program, according to the Food Research Center. According to the Bureau of Economic Analysis, benefit spending is soaring to new highs. The recession is driving the safety net of government benefits to a historic high, as $1 of every $6 of Americans' income is now coming in the form of a federal or state check or voucher. Benefits such as Social Security, food stamps, unemployment insurance, and health care accounted for 16.2% of personal income in the first quarter of 2009, according to the Bureau of Economic Analysis. That's the highest percentage since the government began compiling records in 1929. In all, government spending on benefits will top $2 trillion in 2009, an average of $17,000 provided to each U.S. household, according to federal data. Benefits rose at a 19% annual rate in the first quarter compared to the last 3 months of 2008. The recession caused about half of the increase, according to the report. Unemployment insurance nearly tripled in the past year. The other half is the result of policies enacted during President George W. Bush's first term. Economist Dean Baker of the Liberal Center for Economic and Policy Research said, and I quote, "The increase in social spending is still relatively modest given the severity of the downturn. We're not France." Adam Lerick, economist of the Conservative American Enterprise Institute, says the benefits explosion will eventually lead to an economic crisis. Quote, "We've seen this movie before in many countries. It always has the same ending." Nevada, Michigan, and California had the biggest per capita increase in bankruptcy filings in May, according to AACER, which is the San Francisco Chronicle reporting the state's unemployment fund is short by billions. California is paying out so much for jobless benefits and collecting so little in payroll taxes that its unemployment insurance fund could be $17.8 billion in debt by the end of 2010. According to a new report from the State Employment Development Department. This latest fiscal crisis won't immediately affect the 1.1 million Californians now collecting benefits because the state is using an interest-free federal loan to cover their checks. But the state is supposed to repay that loan and restore its unemployment fund to solvency by 2011, and right now policymakers aren't sure exactly how to do that or at what cost. Bud Bridger, fiscal officer for the Unemployment Insurance Program, had this to say. "The deficit that California looks like it is facing is staggering. To rebalance the system and pay back the federal loan, lawmakers must raise payroll taxes on employers, reduce benefits for recipients, or both. In 2009 and 2010, the state expects to pay out $29 billion in benefits. it will collect just $11 billion. Alicia Trost, spokeswoman for State Senate President Pro Tem Daryl Steinberg, said legislative leaders met with business and labor officials on Monday to discuss the employment issue, but it took a backseat to more pressing problems. We're going to have to address it, Trost said. But the most important thing now is to close the current budget shortfall. Ladies and gentlemen, collectively, this is a stunning series of problems, both nationally and locally. California is $17.8 billion in the hole and counting on unemployment insurance, but the legislature is not even looking at the situation because of more pressing problems and because the state is using an interest-free federal loan to cover benefits. Excuse me, but is this $17.8 billion deficit in addition to the $24 billion budget deficit? How the hell is California going to pay that back and fix a $24 billion budget deficit that without a doubt will cause a massive increase in unemployment? Has anyone factored that in? How can loans of $17.8 billion not be considered as part of the deficit that needs to be fixed? What about California pension promises that cannot possibly be met? Ay, 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 ay. What a catastrophe, ladies and gentlemen. What times to be living in, huh? All right, let's have a call from Jim in New York. Hi, Jim. How are you doing?
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call. I regularly watch CNBC, and they talk about commodities. I know that you're not a buyer of gold or things like that, but they never talk about silver, and I just think it's kind of strange. They talk about copper. They talk about oil. Is there I read some things that, you know, they're trying to keep the price artificially low, but is there any reason why it should be so low? Is it a bad investment?
Okay, there are both fundamental technical and sort of social reasons, Jim, but I guess you want me to talk about silver, is that right, or commodities in general?
Well, silver, it just seems like they never talk about it. It's like taboo almost or something. I don't know, it's strange.
Well, think about silver. I mean, you know, silver basically was used, one of its major applications was in old-style photography, wasn't it? You know, with the use of silver in the photographic process. And that's,
right,
of course, gone completely by the wayside now with digital photography. A lot of these metals don't have the same applications, like copper, used in copper wiring for telephone exchanges. Well, of course, it's all digital now, so that's disappeared. Many of these commodities simply do not have the importance that they used to have, which would explain why they really haven't made that much progress in monetary terms. The other thing you need to realize is that on an economic basis, the world has never seen so much printing of artificial money, of fiat money, as we're seeing today. And, you know, when you have that amount of money swilling around the system, you use it. You tend to buy things with it that are of use to you. I mean, how much use would it be to you if I delivered to your front door a container full of copper wiring? You know, how about silver? What would you like to do with some silver if it arrived unexpectedly in the middle of the night? You know, what you want, what the consumer wants, is things, and things which don't necessarily use silver and plastic in the making. You know, cars, vacations, schooling, countertops, the kind of things that really were a function of the new age that we've been living through since the mid-90s, of people buying things they didn't need with money they didn't have. That was much more important to the consumer than going out and buying gold and silver and copper and all these different things, which were useful in the past as investment alternatives. But today, they're kind of irrelevant, and I can only explain that. I mean, when I look at gold at $950 an ounce, or silver, both of which are sharply down today, I may say, in the markets, you know, and I look and see how bullish everybody is on these commodities. I mean, it is absolutely stunning. Everybody wants you to buy gold and silver and oil and, you know, all these things. I don't think I've ever seen a period, except perhaps in the late 70s, very late, last year, the 79 and early 80, where people were so bullish on the metals. This is terribly bad, by the way, as a sign for bullishness in a market when everybody is yelling at you to buy, because quite simply it means that everybody's already bought these things.
Yeah.
And there's really no more buyers there to take up the slack. But the world has changed. I mean, it really has. I just don't think that people latch onto these old-style commodities as they did before. There may be other explanations, Jim. I don't know what they may be, but there's a couple, or maybe three, hopefully it will, you know, give you something to think about as the prices of these things tumbles down, along with so many people's wealth, which has been sucked in, you know, courtesy of the advisors who told them that, you know, inflation was in our future and they'd better buy gold and silver and it's going to $50,000 an ounce, all this kind of nonsense. You know, it's just sad, but that's the way it goes. And I guess it takes years of experience to see through this kind of hollow nonsense. Okay?
Okay.
Thank you very much for your question. All right. We're going to go through some more mail here now, as we might as well take the opportunity of doing so. Peter Marciano came in on Thursday after the end of the show with an email saying, "Hello, Richard. With the current state of healthcare and its abominable costs in the U.S., and the lives that are destroyed by these costs, what do you see as a possible solution? All the best, Peter." Peter, I'm sorry to say this. The solution is an all-out, full-scale revolution. A revolution that will make the revolution of the 18th century pale in comparison. Until the people get up and show the legislators that they are not prepared to tolerate this nonsense anymore. Until that happens, nothing will happen, Peter. Nothing. Because the entrenched interests are simply too strong. And so it will not work. It doesn't matter how much they try, what they do, what kind of collective process they put into place to change things, nothing will happen, guaranteed. But the process will move very fast, Peter. It won't take very long for people to rise up and just decide that they have been had. They have been taken over the, raked over the coals, and it's time to put an end to it. And it's very scary, and it's one of the reasons that I'm leaving this country. But I tell you, I have warned you, I have explained the facts, and now it will soon be time to sit back and watch the fireworks. And actually, this brings up, interestingly enough, Peter, this brings up another email which I had, which I was intending to read, I don't know, maybe later on, but this is as good a time as any. This is a horror story of the healthcare. And it comes from an anonymous listener who was asked not to be identified, who says, "Richard, I may turn out to be one of those who skew the U.S. stats on longevity downward. However, I have always exercised, and while my eating habits weren't great, I didn't overeat, and I stayed away from junk food. Still, I got a severe cancer at 50. I don't know how or why. So my life expectancy is 55 if I am lucky. So far, I've made it 2 years and 4 months from the removal of the tumor. I had a 50% chance to get this far, and now I think I have a 70% chance to get to 55. My dad is 90, and he is probably dying of cancer. He was treated for colon cancer late in 2007, and then had a metastatic lump in his lung removed in April 2008. I talked to him yesterday, and he told me he isn't eating much, just doesn't feel like it. He probably doesn't have much time left. However, he and I will probably average out to a life expectancy of 72 if I make it to 55. He has never spent much time at the doctor until the last year and a half. Once he went in for that cancer surgery at 88, he was trapped in the system and hasn't been able to break free. The worst thing is that he is mostly being paid for by Medicare and his supplemental plan. His life is being extended by a couple of years at a cost of well over $250,000 so far. It's costing the Medicare system the bulk of that. I'm not saying he shouldn't have got the care, but I wonder if there weren't a better way to deal with his cancer than what they did. It's strange. I had to pay for my cancer or die, and I was only 50. He was 88 and not far from death, and the system paid for his care without regard for the benefit. If my dad died, it wouldn't be a big loss. No one depends on him. If I die, I leave a wife who is just now trying to finish up her degree after being a mom for 29 years, two very dysfunctional kids in their 20s, a grandson who is being raised by his two sets of grandparents, an 18-year-old who is just starting college, and a 14-year-old who will be a freshman in high school next year. It's a strange system that doesn't weigh cost and benefit, just ability to pay. I thought that was a very powerful email. It really does bring the whole sorry plight into light, doesn't it? Very, very grim indeed. All right. Welcome to Al Berry, who came in after the show last week with a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10-word question. What are the 6 safest currencies and countries to deposit money? Well, ladies and gentlemen, I still believe that the United States dollar is not yet ready to collapse. I've been getting frantic questions from people over the phone asking me, is it time to sell the dollar? Is it time we should sell the dollar? I do not think so. I think that at the time, for the time being, the dollar is as good a currency as any. I am not saying that it's better than any. I'm simply saying that currency speculation is not advisable at this time. There are too many unknowns, too many cross currents of problems to be able to really assess any given longer-term trend in any particular currency. The UK currency, to all intents and purposes, should be under tremendous attack. The government is on the verge of toppling. The debt situation is even worse than in the United States, if that's possible. But I still wouldn't speculate against the British pound at this point. I think you want to stay, possibly, with a mix of currencies. Some of the currencies, Al, that you might want to think about are the Norwegian and Swedish krona, the Canadian dollar, maybe even the New Zealand dollar and the Australian dollar. And, of course, needless to say, goes without saying, last but not least, the Singapore dollar. But it is very hard to buy Singapore dollars. I tried to buy some bonds for some clients a while back, and they are not open to foreigners. So do your best. Anyway, that's the answer that I have for you there, Al. All right, so then I got somebody who calls himself Avid Listener, but his email begins with the word Doug, so I'm going to call you Doug, Avid Listener. Now I see anonymous. Well, I don't suppose that really matters. I mean, there are enough Dougs in the world to keep you alive for any amount of time, so never mind. Anyway, greetings, Richard. Something stark just occurred to me while you were reading out your contact info. How will we, your listeners, be able to call you in the future once you've made your transition to Sing Sing? I dare say my long-distance plan covers international. Will we be solely reliant on email correspondences? Avid Listener. Answer, no. The wonders of modern-day technology have, in fact, an answer for all of you, ladies and gentlemen, and I probably should have mentioned this by now. It is an important omission to the things that I should talk to you about, namely that when I move to Singapore, the technology of our office will allow you to call the same toll-free number, and I shall simply pick up the phone in Singapore. If it is the fact that my voice sounds heavy and hollow, it means that you have woken me up, for which I will not thank you, but I will nevertheless attempt to answer your questions. In the spirit of true loyalty and faith to the listeners of the Progressive Radio Network. So, no, ladies and gentlemen, continue to call the same number when I get to Singapore, and we shall attempt to provide you with excellent service, just as we always have. So, emails will stay the same, phone numbers will stay the same, I will stay the same. The only thing that will actually change is the time of the wake-up call, which will be at 10 a.m., or so I am given to understand. Hopefully on Tuesdays and Fridays or on Mondays and Thursdays, which will effectively put an end to any social life I might wish to have on either of those nights. Why? Because by the time I call you at 10 a.m. on Monday, it will be 10 p.m. The same day. So I shall do my job, and hopefully you will benefit from it. Thank you, Doug. I get another one from, hi, Richard, to begin with, I would like to remain anonymous, so anonymous you shall remain. I would like to ask you a few questions. One, there are three. One, you've been talking recently about the bonds being the next bubble. I live in Canada, Edmonton, Alberta, and I would like to know if this applies to Canadian bonds as well. Well, yes, anonymous, it does. Basically, pretty much bonds move in sync wherever you are, if only because countries want to compete for the money, and so they tend to ensure that their interest rates remain competitive wherever they are, especially if they are in first world countries or countries with the harder currencies. All bets are off when it comes to Zimbabwe, but in any of the countries that you may be interested in, including Canada, if United States bonds rise or rather fall in price and rise in interest, then you will indeed find that the same thing will happen in Canada. Two, I would also like to hear your opinion about Canadian real estate. Last year, I had a fair amount of cash, which I was keeping in my savings account as a potential down payment for a future property. When real estate prices skyrocketed, I decided to keep renting and hold on to the cash. You are still advising people in the U.S. not to put money into real estate. Would the same apply to Canada? Answer, yes. Simple as that, yes. Do not buy real estate anywhere. When the time does come to start buying real estate, I shall bow out of the international advisory business, because every country will be or become a law unto itself. But for the time being, I think it's safe to say that anywhere you go, you are strongly advised to stay away from real estate. Three, my final question is about asset allocation. A couple of years ago, I read the Intelligent Asset Allocator book by William Bernstein and decided to follow the asset allocation investment strategy described in the book. I also followed your advice and didn't put the cash from my down payment mentioned above into the stock market last year, which I was considering at the time. As a result, my current portfolio consists of 45% cash, 25% bonds, and the remaining 30% is a mix of stock market index funds diversified around the globe. Well, before I carry on, Anonymous, you just said that you didn't put your money into the stock market. And then you say the remaining 30% is a mixture of stock market index funds diversified around the globe. But that, to me, tells me that it is in the stock market. Anonymous, hello, are you listening? Get it out. Sell the 30% stock market index funds now, okay? Put the phone down and don't even listen to the rest of the answer to your question. You don't have time. All right. To continue, however, my target asset allocation would have to be a mix of 70% globally diversified equities, 25% short-term bonds, and 5% cash. Your comments are easy to understand and make sense, but I'm worried that by following your advice, I would actually be trying to time the market, which very few people can successfully do in the long run. What do you think about asset allocation in general, and how to achieve the balance between timing the market and having a long-term investment strategy? Thank you very much for all your great work. Well, Anonymous, I have a very, very important message for you. This nonsense about asset allocation is just an excuse from the brokers to make sure that whatever you buy, hopefully, not you, your portfolio will not go down, because they'll say that if the stocks go up, the bonds will go down, and if the bonds go up, the stocks go down, and if gold goes up, the dollar will go down, the dollar goes up, the gold will go down. All these things may or may not be true, but they are hokey. in a time of maximum economic disturbance, which is what we have here, a full-scale depression, you do not want to worry about buying 70% globally diversified equities, Anonymous. Get out of your equities right away, and the same applies to everybody else. Do not hold stocks. How more better can I put this? Did I not say the very same thing about real estate? Did I not say it clearly enough for those who didn't do it? Now I say it again. Get out of your stocks. You know, if there's anybody who doesn't speak English here, I will try and say it in another language. But let me know. I really mean this. This is a devastating decline that we're looking at here. All right? So it looks like to me that you've been confused and misled by these people because, you know, they're telling you that stock, it seems that, you know, stock market index funds are stocks in effect. They're stock substitutes, you know? And so don't do it. Get out. Asset allocation is nonsense. Things either work or they don't work. They don't half work. And they certainly don't always go hand in hand with another allocation mix which says it that one thing will go up if the other goes down. It just doesn't work like that. And don't believe those who tell you it does. This is what we all learned. This is what we were all taught. Allocate your assets, ladies and gentlemen. That's what we were told. You know, make sure your clients are allocated nicely in a mix of bonds and stocks. And then they had this theory that, you know, you had to have the percentage of bonds that pertained to your age. So if you were 60, you had 60% of bonds in your portfolio. If you were 70, you had 70% of bonds. It's all hokey hogwash and rubbish, ladies and gentlemen. Don't listen to a word of it. It's either right or it's wrong. And there's no kind of half measures attached. So hope I've made my point. Thank you, Anonymous. Oh, we have a tiny little rant, three-line rant from Steve here. Who says, Richard, it seems our friends in China have lost interest in our long-term debt. Rates are up large today. Rates are going up and they're going to shake our house of cards. Nothing the Fed does can restart public spending. Our shoppers are entering step two of the 12-step Spenders Anonymous program. Keep your purse zipped tight. Steve Kruger. Thank you, Steve. You've done my job for me. I have no further comment. Couldn't say it better myself. All right. Ronnie Davis has written in, "Are wrong," she writes, or he writes. I actually don't know if Ronnie is a girl's or a boy's name, but in this particular category, so forgive me. Richard, I spent the last few days researching the CPI. I compared the numbers on BLS with my own experience. I reviewed the implications on bank rates, treasury notes, and even the World Bank and IMF outputs. The news is not happy. These numbers appear deeply flawed. What can we do? Well, I say, what we can do is ignore the whole lot. Just ignore it. Take no notice. Pay no attention to this nonsense. It isn't going to do you any good and will do you a lot of harm. These make no mistake about these big organizations. They're not in it for you and they're not in it for the poor people in the, you know, developing nations. They're in it for themselves and for what they can get out of it. And if you don't believe me, ask anybody from one of these Eastern European countries what's happening now as the, you know, Western European banks are busy desperately trying to scramble and claw back some of the money they've lost in these countries. The idea of giving the money to the countries was to help the countries, but when things went bad, all they wanted was their money back. So all they really wanted in the first place was profits from the so-called assistance. So I wouldn't, when I read about the IMF and the World Bank, my eyes glaze over. I have a hard time keeping awake and trying to find something intelligent to say. So forget all about that. That's my advice to you, ladies and gentlemen. All right. Frank Devlin came in with a long rant. We've got a little time left. We've got about 15 minutes. I think we have time. I think it's quite good, so I'm going to read it. He sent it on June the 2nd, which I guess was just under a week ago. And it's called Upping the Ante. And it goes as follows. Richard, as Salenti and Kunstler and Prechter have said for quite a while now, this current disaster will not end well. Another stepping stone on the road to riot was laid with the theft of blue-collar auto workers' pensions as described in the following article by Greg Palast. And Greg Palast, by the way, is a contributor to the Progressive Radio Network, as you may know. Grand Theft Auto, How Stevie the Rat Bankrupted GM by Greg Palast. Screw the auto workers. They may be crying about General Motors bankruptcy today, but dumping 40,000 of the last 60,000 union jobs into a mass grave won't spoil Jamie Dimon's day. Dimon is the CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase Bank. While GM workers are losing their retirement health benefits, their jobs, their life savings, while shareholders are getting zilch and many creditors getting hosed, a few privileged GM lenders led by Morgan and Citibank expect to get back 100% of their loans to GM, a stunning $6 billion. The way these banks are getting their $6 billion bonanza is stone-cold illegal. I smell a rat. Stevie the Rat, to be precise. Stephen Ratner, Barack Obama's car czar, the man who essentially ordered GM into bankruptcy this morning. When a company goes bankrupt, everyone takes a hit, fair or not. Workers lose some contract wages, stockholders get wiped out, and creditors get fragments of what's left. That's the law. What workers don't lose is their pensions, including old age health funds, already taken from their wages and held in their name. But not this time. Stevie the Rat has a different plan for GM. Grab the pension funds to pay off Morgan and Citi. Here's the scheme. Ratner is demanding the bankruptcy court simply wipe away the money GM owes workers for their retirement health insurance. Cash in the insurance fund would be replaced by GM stock. The percentage may be 17% of GM stock or 25%, whatever. 17% or 25% is worth, well, just try paying for your dialysis with 50 shares of bankrupt auto stock. Yet Citibank of Morgan says Ratner should get their whole enchilada. $6 billion right now and in cash from a company that can't pay for auto parts or worker eye exams. So what's wrong with seizing workers' pension fund money in a bankruptcy? The answer, Mr. Obama, Mr. Law Professor, is that it's illegal. In 1974, after a series of scandalous takedowns of pension and retirement funds during the Nixon era, Congress passed the Employee Retirement Income Security Act. ERISA says you can't seize workers' pension funds, whether monthly payments or health insurance, any more than you can seize their private bank accounts. And that's because they're the same thing. Workers give up wages in return for retirement benefits. The law is darn explicit that grabbing pension money is a no-no. Company executives must hold these retirement funds as fiduciaries. Here's the law, Professor Obama, as described on the government's own website under the heading Health Plans and Benefits. The primary responsibility of fiduciaries is to run the plan solely in the interest of participants and beneficiaries and for the exclusive purpose of providing benefits. End of quote. Every business in America that runs short of cash would love to dip into retirement kitties, but it's not their money any more than a banker can seize your account when the bank's a little short. A plan's assets are for the plan's members only, not for Mr. Dimon nor Mr. Rubin. Yet, in effect, the Obama administration is demanding that money for an elderly auto worker's spleen should be siphoned off to feed the TARP babies. Workers go without lung transplants, so Dimon and Rubin can pimp out their ride. This is another Guantanamo moment for the Obama administration, channeling Nixon to endorse the preventive detention of retiree health insurance. Filching GM pensions assets doesn't become legal because the cash due the fund is replaced with GM stock. Congress saw through that switcheroo by requiring that companies as fiduciaries must, quote, act prudently and must diversify the plan's investments in order to minimize the risk of large losses, end of quote. By diversify for safety, the law does not mean put 100% of worker funds into a single busted company's stock. This is dangerous business. The Ratner plan opens the floodgate to every politically connected or down-on-their-luck company seeking to drain healthcare retirement funds. Pensions are wiped away and two connected banks don't even get a haircut. How come Citi and Morgan aren't asked, like other workers and creditors, to take stock in GM? As Butch said to Sundance, who are these guys? You remember Morgan and Citi? These are the corporate welfare queens who've already sucked up over $333 billion in aid from the U.S. Treasury and Federal Reserve. Not coincidentally, Citi, the big winner, has paid over $100 million to Robert Rubin, the former U.S. Treasury Secretary. Rubin was Obama's point man in winning banks' endorsement and campaign donations, by far his largest source of his corporate funding. With GM's last dying dimes about to fall into one pocket and the Obama Treasury in his other pocket, Morgan's Jamie Dimon is correct in saying that the last 12 months will prove to be the bank's finest year ever. Which leads us to ask the question, is the forced bankruptcy of GM, the elimination of tens of thousands of jobs, just a collection action for favored financiers? And it's been a good year for Senor Ratner. While the Obama administration made a big deal out of Ratner's youth spent working for the Steelworkers Union, they tried to sweep under the chassis that Ratner was one of the privileged select group of investors in Cerberus Capital, the owners of Chrysler. Owning is a loose term. Cerberus owned Chrysler the way a cannibal hosts you for dinner. Cerberus paid nothing for Chrysler. Indeed, they were paid billions by Germany's Daimler Corporation to haul it away. Cerberus kept the cash, then dumped Chrysler's bankrupt course on the U.S. taxpayer. Cerberus, by the way, named itself after the Romans' mythical three-headed dog guarding the gates of hell. Subtle, these guys are not. While Stevie the Rat sold his interest in the dog from hell when he became car czar, he never relinquished his post at the shop of vultures called Quadrangle Hedge Fund. Ratner's personal net worth stands at roughly $500 million. This is Obama's working class hero. If you ran a business and played fast and loose with your workers' funds, you could land in prison. Stevie the Rat's plan is nothing less than grand theft auto pension. It doesn't make it any less of a crime if the president drives the getaway car. When the big O takes something from the eunuchs who populate the fawning press corps, maybe they will notice his personnel choices resemble those of someone taking advice from Tony Soprano. Yes, the emperor has a new set of clothes. They came from your closet. From the foxhole, Frank. Well, Frank, to say, excellent article, absolutely spot on, right on the mark. Well, one of the many bogus concepts that equity investors and TV pundits use to justify their continued bullishness is the notion that even if poor and middle-class Americans cut back on their consumption, the wealthy won't. In other words, the latter's spending habits are, to use a phrase that's becoming increasingly popular nowadays, recession-proof. Well, if you want something to add to the scrap heap of stupid ideas, according to a MarketWire report, it looks that the affluent are having their own comeuppance and pain alongside everybody else, and contained and decoupling appear to be two other terms which correspond to problems that aren't. Anyway, there's a new survey reveals that who is not reducing expenditures and who is cutting back due to concerns about rise in everyday expenses, the poor economy and decline in the stock market. The economists are waiting for more data before declaring officially a recession. The affluent market has clearly recognized the poor state of the economy. In a new survey of the wealthiest 10% of households, the index of 52 for current business conditions represents a sharp drop of 56 points from the fall 2007 survey and is at its lowest level since the fall 2002 survey. This survey, which is the 13th in a series of twice-yearly tracking studies by the American Affluence Research Center, reveals which segments of the affluent market are reducing or deferring expenditures and which are not due to current economic conditions, why they are reducing their expenditures, and for what type of products and services spending is being cut back. The survey also explores what types of mortgages, if any, exist on the primary residence, how much equity exists in the home's value, and how these factors may influence future spending plans. The survey is representative of the wealthiest 10% of households, which according to the Fed account for almost 70% of the total net worth of all U.S. households and 40% of total U.S. household income, thus representing about 33% of the total U.S. economy. Highlights of this national survey of 467 affluent men and women can be found on www.affluenceresearch.org. The survey participants have an average income of $316,000, an average net worth of $3.1 million, and average investable assets of $1.5 million. Those with the highest incomes, net worth, and equity in their homes tended to be more positive in their spending plans and less likely to be cutting back. The Composite Affluent and Consumer Expectations 12-Month Economic Outlook Index of 102, while hovering near historic lows, still represents a modestly positive outlook overall. Despite the negative index of 99 for future business conditions, the composite index essentially held even with the fall 2007 survey due to modest increases in the indexes for business conditions and the stock market. The index for household income, the third element of the composite index, was down slightly, but still in positive equity. Over half the respondents have no plans to make any of eight major expenditures in the next 12 months. This is an historic high for the survey. Plans for motor vehicle acquisitions and building a new primary residence are historic lows. Major home remodeling equaled its historic low. Plans to cruise are effectively at a historic low. Plans to acquire a vacation residence by building new or purchasing an existing home have never been lower other than in the fall 2005 survey. Of the 17 categories of products and services for which expected changes in spending attract, only one, domestic vacation travel, is in positive territory. The indexes for eight of the 17 categories equaled or established their historic lows. The future spending index average of 87.3 is at a historic low. Almost 8 in 10 of affluent Americans have a mortgage on their primary residence. About 40% of those 60 years plus and 47% of those with net worth of $6 million plus have no mortgage. Over two-thirds of those with mortgages have equity equal to 50% or more of the residence value. So things don't look too good even for the wealthy either, but they probably have further to go, so maybe they don't need quite as much sympathy as the rest of us. Anyway, be that as it may, ladies and gentlemen, it has, as always, been a pleasure talking to you. I will be back on Thursday at 2 p.m. sharp Eastern Time with another edition of the Wake Up Call. This is Richard Martin saying bye-bye till then.